by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, and no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest my dab in the middle of it.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got really a fine guest. He's been with us at least three or four times before. His name is James Tracy. Welcome to our program, James Tracy.
Hi, George. Very happy to be here.
Well, I'll tell you what. Tell our listening audience, the people out there that haven't heard you yet, a little bit about your background. Would you please?
Sure. I am a professor of communication at Florida Atlantic University. I did my PhD in mass communication at University of Iowa completed that back in 2002. And much of what I look at is political communication and the like, and alternative media. And I also do a considerable amount of media criticism myself on my own website, blog, memoryholeblog.com.
Oh, that's great. You've run into a few problems, in the last 8-10 months? Tell us a little bit about your trials and tribulations lately.
Yeah, well, that began shortly after I had written a number of pieces analyzing the news coverage of the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre back in December, and those pieces came out between December 20th and January 6th, January 7th, and then, of course, there was the local newspaper here. They focused on some of my remarks and observations, and that story was picked up by the Drudge Reports, I think, on January 8th, and it's something that more or less went viral, became an international story, and so there was a great deal of scrutiny that was focused on Florida Atlantic University and on me. How could this guy be saying that the event didn't take place as it was reported or what have you? And so there was a great deal of negative publicity that the university had to deal with. And really, instead of coming out and defending me or anything of the like, they sought to distance themselves from me, because granted, the story itself was very sensational, the story about the school massacre and so on and so forth, and very emotional. I was talking about it within a few weeks of it having taken place, so to a certain degree I could understand, I could see the outrage, and also I think this was something that the major media essentially fanned the flames of, you know, from the print media and things on the internet to CNN.
Yes.
And, so about 10 days after that, I had a sit-down meeting with the administration, with a couple of administrators, and they expressed, concern about the story, the way that it played out. But frankly, I did as well. And they brought up the matter of there being a disclaimer on the website. They asked if there was on my website, and I said, yes, there has been ever since I began the website back in early 2012. And then they provided a letter to me about 10 days after that, and it was really a misrepresentation of what took place at the meeting. And so I had to send a letter in response to their letter stating that this is wrong and this is incorrect and what have you. And didn't hear anything back, and then at the end of March, I got a letter of discipline or a letter of reprimand because I had published three letters in support of me. Two of them were in support of me, on the blog that referenced FAU. And because they referenced FAU, the administration were arguing that this was something that was in violation of what we discussed. Although when we initially talked, I had explained to them in no uncertain terms, there's been a disclaimer on the site. I went to the Internet Archive and said, here, it's been there since at least July, and so forth. So that's something where we are presently moving towards arbitration. The union has represented me in this fashion, and that's where we're actually headed. I think that the administration itself, they don't want to go that route because they really don't have a case. And I think that at this stage, they are more or less being prodded by members of the board of trustees at the university, all of whom are political appointees, some of them gubernatorial, and some of, you know, they have political ties, and they want to see something done with regard to what I have been doing, more or less on my own time.
Right.
So that's where we presently stand, and. They're asking to concede. They're asking to take the letter out of my file if I will somewhat alter the disclaimer and make it more prominent on my site, and also inform them whenever I write a blog that might be controversial. Whenever I write a blog post, excuse me, that might be controversial. Well, you know, if you know my website, almost everything I touch upon will rub someone the wrong way. It's media and political criticism, and it's intended to be provocative commentary. So conceding something like that would actually probably open me up to further action on their part. So I don't intend to do that, and we will continue towards the arbitration. Now, there's another matter as well. They've also attempted what I argue to be retaliation in the way in which my course schedule has been set up. It's rather unusual without any sort of consultation, which is typical, at least that's been my experience the past 10 years. It's typical to consult with faculty as to when they're going to be scheduled, what time their classes are going to be scheduled, and so forth. They didn't even exercise that degree of consideration this time around for my classes this fall. So that's a little bit more, that's not quite as significant, but it's still, something whereby they're trying to make life a little bit uncomfortable.
Well, whatever happened to truth and all that on the campuses, you know?
That's exactly...
It seemed like to me, when I was growing up, that the universities and colleges is where you could speak your mind, you know, without, you know what I mean, being worried about someone coming after you, you know?
That's exactly how I felt. And none of my colleagues and, of course, the administration any journalists have come forward and said, hey, I'd like to debate you on what you've asserted here. It's not even addressing me on that particular type of ground. Rather, it is just condemning me.
Right.
Usually with, you know, the conspiracy theory label, which is fairly common. It's something that I've learned to live with. And, you know, it's more or less died down. I wrote a couple of articles on the Boston Marathon bombing as well.
Right.
And those didn't receive nearly the degree of press attention as Sandy Hook, even though I did have the local television newscasters or reporters at my door, at my residence and at my my place of work outside the classroom after those posts came out.
Right. You know, the Boston Massacre, the two brothers, their uncle was involved in oil over there in the Caspian Sea area. So, I mean, it got to be where they started publicizing that. And some, it's just one thing after another today, isn't it? What? You know,
it really is, and if we have, you know, the mainstream media that are generally asleep at the wheel.
Yes, yes.
then this stuff isn't brought to the, you know, brought to the fore, brought to the majority of the public. We know that there are a good many alternative media outlets that are on the job, that are doing that type of important work. But they unfortunately don't reach the mainstream.
That's exactly right. We in the alternative media, and of course Alex Jones and myself and GCN and all those networks like that, we're trying to establish some kind of clarity and order here, because this is very chaotic, is it not?
It certainly is, yeah. Especially as we speak today. We don't actually know what's going to go on there in the Eastern Mediterranean with regard to Syria and
we don't, do we?
Right. It's very unnerving. Some contend that these the next few days may be as momentous as the Cuban Missile Crisis was.
You know, Obama made a statement today, and I've only read excerpts of it. You know, I haven't reviewed it thoroughly. I've been pretty busy today. And it looks like he said some things that he's used a technique of neuro-linguistic programming.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like some of the language in today's speech was very, very vague, you know,
mm-hmm.
and about what he's thinking about doing but has not really made a decision. I don't have that right before me. Maybe I can pull that up in a second. But he seems to come out with these very, very vague statements, and I know that that's one of the techniques of neuro-linguistic programmers, you know, people that
right.
use those kinds of techniques. And they sort of let everyone else sort of fill in the blanks as to what those vague statements mean. Have you run into other things like this before?
Well, Obama is certainly, I think, very well trained in that regard.
Yes.
With regard to his rhetoric and his cadence and his delivery. And, of course, it's all done on teleprompters, but nevertheless.
Yes.
He's very, very talented. One of the most talented. Of course, there's not, very much substance behind it. But Obama, more than anything else, is image. In his case, that largely does trump any substantive what have you. So, there are plenty of examples that one could look to. I wrote a piece today on Memory Hole blog about how we're at that kind of crossroads in history, and we've been here before. And really, you go back to Woodrow Wilson, throughout the past 100 years, every time we've been led into a major war, a major conflict, it's all been based on deceit. It's all been based on lies. You know, it began in World War with leading the U.S. a very reluctant public into World War I back in 1917. We saw this sort of duplicity similarly exercised in 1941 with Pearl Harbor. Similar sort of thing in 1950 with the Korean War. The Tonkin Gulf, 1964. Nixon's Vietnamization of Vietnam and the bombing
yes.
of Cambodia in the late 60s and early 70s, all these things, they involve false flags. They involve, outright deception of the American public and Congress. Most of the things, I just have some quotes from most of these presidents' addresses to Congress on the eve of war. And we know now, in hindsight, that all of them, leading up to Obama, who is, in many ways perhaps the most phony president that we actually have, we don't really even know about his background, which you can't say that in polite company.
Yeah, we don't even know. Yeah, we don't even know his real background, because he gives us, forgeries on, birth certificates, and they're obvious forgeries.
Right. Yeah.
But. That's some of us feel that was to cover his real father, see, and so that's possible. I'm not sure. How can we prove it yet, right?
I think that's one of the most compelling scenarios, is that his father is Frank Marshall Davis.
Yes, I do too. I think his father was, or his father was Frank Marshall Davis, and they look alike at about 35 or 40 years of age. There's
do.
A photograph that is totally close, very, very close. But I mean, you know, the American public is still, what, in a sleep state, mesmerized, hypnotic, as well, Roy Masters used to say. So are they going to wake up out of that mesmerized, hypnotic sleep state, James?
Well, the last few days have been some cause for optimism. I mean,
yes, I would agree.
Washington Post Reuters poll that was conducted on Wednesday that indicated that only 9% of the U.S. public support military action against Syria. So, you know, the honeymoon is obviously over with regard to Obama. And one of the things they have left is, you know, like playing the race card as they've done with the whole Trayvon Martin affair. And to be divisive, you know, just to divide us. That's been a technique of the ruling class for an awfully long time. And I think that the charm is finally wearing off. And it's unfortunate that it didn't take place back in 2011 because we saw the destruction of Libya, which was really, it really had the potential to for the basis of a united African continent.
Well, he turned his back on Congress, did he not? He ignored Congress.
Yes, he did. And I'm afraid that... he's going to do the same thing again this weekend because he has the corporate mainstream media prodding him to do something, saying, "Oh well, you've said that they've crossed the red line and what have you." And the New York Times had an editorial a couple of days ago to this effect, and the Washington Post. But that's not representative of the American public. The American public does not want to go to another war. I don't, you know, if you put it to them with the facts. Most everyone would agree, and this poll is reflective of that. So that's very encouraging. Now, I don't think that that's necessarily going to persuade the Obama or, you know, the people surrounding him from having what they refer to as a limited surgical strike on certain targets in Syria. And this weekend would be the time to do it. You know, there's the college football and there's the pro football. People are going to be distracted, and people are anyway on the weekend, and Saturday's a pretty much a dead news day. So, you know, they may very well try to do something this weekend.
And right.
Yeah,
that's a very interesting thing. They're so into what's not that important, like sports, aren't they?
I'm sorry, the...
they're into unimportant things sometimes.
A good percentage of the public, yeah. That's true, you know. They have to be convinced that reality is much more interesting than this fantasy that we see on TV, whether it's, you know, narratives that are contrived that are on during prime time, or whether it's sports. And that's not to say that there aren't places for entertainment, but, you know, our entertainment also, it melds into the news. You know, these sagas, as I had said, for example, Trayvon Martin is a good example, but there are plenty of other examples of courtroom-type dramas that play out in real life and that are just belabored by the major media, when, in fact, there are other types of things happening in the courtroom that we really should be paying attention to. Say, for example, you know, James Holmes, or what's going on with the investigation following Sandy Hook, or the Boston Marathon. Bombing. Those things that really deserve a high degree of attention get almost none. And that's how screwed up our major news media are. Ideally, they're supposed to act as a system of surveillance for us. And, you know, there are alternative outlets that do that and do it extremely well. Major media that are supposed to do that act more often than not to distract than to actually tell us the things that we actually need to know as active citizens or potentially active citizens. You know, it seems like it's not just the media. It's like everything is fake. And maybe not everything. That might be too far-reaching. But so much of what we have, when you think about it, is fake. Think about, like, our revenue system, you know, our monetary system is fake.
Yes,
our political leaders are fake. Our food is fake. You know?
Yeah.
Not only is it fake, it's dangerous. You know?
Well, they're putting silicone in it on these chicken fingers and stuff. What's that about?
Yep,
I mean, you know, I talked to a professor, I think he's out of Florida, David Callahan. Are you familiar with him? He wrote The Cheating Culture. And that was an interesting sociological book. He's a sociology professor. Mm-hmm. And what it started saying, and I noticed this years ago, 30 years ago or more, was that some of the, you know, fraternity boys, sorority boys, girls that had some money were paying people to write their papers for them. See?
Yeah.
So the mindset way back 30, 40 years ago was if you win, you're okay. Winning is everything. And it doesn't matter how you get there. If you have to pay to have people write your paper, that's cool. You know, pay somebody. Get it done. Get ahead. See?
Yeah.
And that has translated into the whole public almost mindset. What do you think?
Well, I think there's a certain degree of that that actually does take place at university. I'm not sure how prevalent it is specifically at where I'm employed, but you think about the whole sort of thing that takes place with those that are affluent enough to attend the Ivy League universities. You know, all they more or less have to do is really go through the motions. And granted, they might, you know, if they stay awake and what have you, they may pick up some important things. But a lot of it has to do with the socialization and meeting and creating that sort of network.
We used to never have preparatory classes to go to college.
Right. Yeah.
See what I'm saying? The whole thing has fallen to lower levels here, the education system. But what has caused that, see?
Well, I think that it's the failure of K-12 public education. It's worse in some states than in others. I see a lot of it. I see how there are upperclassmen, juniors and seniors, who cannot actually put a paragraph together. And that's very unfortunate. They've been shortchanged. Part of schooling, what it does is that it makes you, I think that it programs people to think about writing and intellectual activity as being work. And being cooped up in school for, you know, 30, 35 hours a week, well, learning subject matter that might not be all that interesting, and now with things like Common Core, you know, very, very uninteresting and just deadening to any sort of intellectual fiber that a young person might have. You know, it's beaten out of them by the time they're like 10 or 12 when they go through that sort of system. It's gotten worse and worse, and now with standardized testing, I see that students are just frequently turned off. So by the time that they reach university and they do actually want to take, you know, they do come to myself and other college instructors, that's a big uphill battle to contend with because they're not, and that's not all of them, but I'm saying a good percentage of them just really aren't oriented to that sort of activity.
There was a raid on a family in Germany, the Dirk and Petra Wunderlich family, was raided recently, and four of their children were taken away because of homeschooling. What's that about?
Well,
they're coming out with better educations out of homeschooling than some of these other public schools.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, we homeschool our oldest, the one that would be attending second grade at a public school, and find that the regimen that we use, there's a lot more things that we can incorporate she would likely not be getting elsewhere. But I would think that there would be a tax break or the equivalent for those that actually opt to homeschool. We should have a choice. You know, it's just like our healthcare system or the Obamacare. That really is just the further enforcement of allopathic medicine.
Now, yes.
In a free market, you would be able to choose between naturopathic medicine and osteopathic and any range of medical techniques that you see fit for you and your family. But we don't have that at all. This, you know, this, the Obamacare is just going to be a nightmare. You know, it should be the same with education. There should be incentives for those that homeschool, and instead, what you have is persecution of those that take that track.
Well, you know, when you look at it, especially the health system, and you look at eugenics, it looks like that could be they hand in glove, you know. My sister was a med tech, and my brother-in-law was an MD. Here in Austin, and so all I got was the formal medical model, you know, presented to me all the time. See what I mean?
Yeah.
And I've come down on an alternative side of almost on a lot of things, you know. But they're no longer with us. My brother-in-law and my sister passed away a few years ago. But they accepted the regular treatment. You know, they didn't go for any alternative treatments. So.
Yeah, well, I have family members that were in medicine as well, and they, you know, it was generally the allopathic methods more or less all the way, and other things were looked upon, you know, with a bit of derision.
Right.
But I think that there are a lot of people. To a large degree because of the Internet, it's allowed people to do their own research. And people are becoming increasingly aware of the fact that there are natural remedies that are superior to anything that could be created in a lab. And you know, at least for the moment, we have access to those types of things, those substances.
Right. Getting back to the Middle East, what do you see happening in Syria right now, and what sort of your you know, prognosis, or what do you think that might happen there?
Well, there's been a plan afoot for a good many years to actually take over these Middle Eastern countries, and we've seen that project unfold with Afghanistan, with Iraq, with Libya, with Egypt, and now with Syria and perhaps Iran. And it's a matter of, I think, putting in regimes that will yield to the wishes of the United States and larger forces that to a large degree control geopolitical events and so forth. And that's what's taking place now in Syria. We saw this guerrilla war initiated back in February of 2011, and they were able to take out Gaddafi in the fall of 2011. And Syria is quite a bit more difficult of a nut to crack. And you think about what's taken place there. These fighters have been imported.
Yes, they have.
The nastiest of nastiest criminals and thugs you could possibly ever imagine. They, you know, the 100,000 people who are dead, and I would say probably 90% of them were likely killed by these people that have been employed by the United States and the Sunni states and Israel, or have been at least abetted by them, if not directly funded and so forth. So. They're in there raising hell, trying to disrupt the fiber of society, and now is time for the next step. Even though the Assad regime has been quite successful in thwarting their efforts, in thwarting the efforts of this guerrilla war, thus far anyway.
Well, what's amazing, too, is it's like you're saying that people are waking up. The parliament would not present a winning vote for David Cameron just recently. And so he lost his war vote there, you know. And I think they said, if this is accurate, the last one that was voted down was the continuation of the war against the American colonies. Is that right?
It's 1782, I think. Yeah,
1782. So that's a historical vote, would you not say?
Oh, absolutely. And that's another reason, that's another cause for encouragement.
Now, yes, it is.
If there were not any human lives hanging in the balance in Syria today, I would say, boy, I hope Obama goes for it. Let him go ahead and attack, because it's something that could result in his increasing isolation, not only as an American leader, but as a geopolitical leader, you know.
Right.
And I think, you know, it could spell maybe not the demise of NATO, but it certainly would be a thorn in their side as far as the public is concerned, because they would, you know, they would lose that much more credibility. But unfortunately, you've got a lot of people there on the ground. A lot of people have been displaced and refugees and so forth in Syria that are going to suffer. There are these attacks that are carried out, and I think there's a strong probability that they will be, unfortunately.
Yeah, I've been reviewing some things about the Middle East because of Syria, especially, and of course, Libya. And I've been getting into Bernard Lewis and his theories about how to overcome the extreme radical jihadist in the Middle East, or how to deal with the Arab countries. And he'd come up with what he called, or what had been known and is being called the Bernard Lewis plan. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, it's more or less with the Balkanization of the Middle East. Mm-hmm.
Well, that looks like that's what's happening to me right now. And it's along sectarian lines for sure in Syria.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's working. And look at what they did in Libya. There's been recent announcements that some of the eastern tribal, you know, factions want to break off from the main. They're not going for federalism in Libya, see? Mm-hmm. And then you've got the breakup, the dividing line between the Alawites and the Sunni and the Shiites there in Syria. So it's proceeding as planned. And at first I was thinking that this was dangerous to the state of Israel, but it's playing into their hands, it looks like to me.
Because of the whole divide and conquer.
Yeah, they're fractionalizing the whole Middle East into these little Balkan, little provinces, you know, organized around religion or one sect or another. And they're actually the takedown of the nation state within the Arab League. That's occurring. That's what I see.
Yeah, well, the Sunni states also have added incentive to oust Assad because of his Shia bearings. And that's certainly one element of it, I think, as well.
Right, and they have all kinds of maps that came out of the Bernard Lewis plan, you know, of redrawing, you know, the Middle East and so forth. But it's actually creating chaos in many of these countries that had a strong united, you know, nation state. But we supported some of these very harsh regimes also, did we not?
Oh, absolutely.
See?
Beginning with, for example, Saddam Hussein.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, actually, we propped up all over the world dictatorships.
And we still are.
Yes.
We support some of the most brutal dictators. I mean, look at some of the Arab monarchies in the Middle East. They're far more brutal than Assad or Gaddafi could ever be. Not that they're saints.
Right.
But still, you know, they still behead people in the town square and so forth. Granted, Syria had its faults, but you still had different religious, beliefs who were still living more or less in harmony side by side. And, you know, such was the case also in Iraq. And Libya was one of the most modern, modernized countries, probably the most modern country in the African continent. And we know what happened to Gaddafi when he sought a gold-backed currency and really did want to seek out an independent path for that continent.
Yeah, he was becoming a leader of the African continent, was he not?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So they didn't want that, and he had a very strong nation state and a very well funded because of the oil. I'll tell you another thing though that he did was. Towards the end of that conflict down there, there were 37,000 Chinese evacuated out of there. And they were all working primarily in the oil industry down in there, in Libya.
Uh-huh.
So the Chinese had were forging a very good interest in Libyan oil.
Yes, well, they're you know, they're capitalists, they're entrepreneurs. They're going into these areas with goodwill, and they're attempting to forge trading relationships with these countries, in part for the raw materials, but also to industrialize them. Contrary to what we're doing, is going around with our military, creating Israel.
Yeah, exactly, and we want to take them down or assassinate them and run them out or kill them and then take their resources. That's our angle, it looks like.
That's right. I think there's also the intent to install these very malevolent dictatorships throughout the region that will only, in the end, cause us further grief. You know, we've been taking out more or less moderate regimes or regimes that are, you know, really quite popular with, for example, Gaddafi, and replacing it with, you know, just, I mean, really, certainly not regimes that would benefit the Libyan people. And that will be the case with Syria as well. It's not going to be a regime that seeks to have a strong civic sphere or public sphere or will be accommodating the Syrian people themselves, you know, towards various types of social uplift. That's not going to be the case at all with the sort of regime that I think the planners have in mind for Syria.
Right. The I had cause to do a little more research on Libya, and there's about 140 tribes in Libya. Okay, not a total of purely tribals, but there are subgroups. See, okay,
yeah.
And but those subgroups can make up to about 2,000. But there's about 140 tribal units identified, plus with the subgroups made up of families, subfamilies. There's about 2,000 different groups. So the tribal system in Libya is very important, and it has not gone away. See.
Yeah.
So that's why this Eastern bunch, tribal bunch, wants to break off from and don't want to be part of the federalist, the federal, you know, whatever entity of Libya is going to end up being.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's some people that have, you know, theorized or hypothesized that Iraq should have been divided into three different areas, you know, and a northern Kurd, a southern Shiite, and a middle whatever, you know, more of a district of like a District of Columbia or something, you know. I visualized that years ago before we went in there and then share the oil, see. There could have been three states making up a nation of Iraq with the oil revenues being shared equally on a per capita basis, see, within those three states, and then they could have a national assembly. They might have made it then. With what they were trying to do, it's not doing it. And then you have all these terrorists in there. It's horrendous to live there, is it not?
I haven't lived there, but I could imagine that. We've made a mess of that.
I mean, I feel so sorry for the people that have to daily get up and face the next day. I mean, it's just horrendous to try to deal with that kind of a reality.
Right. Well, you don't know if you're going to encounter a bomb in the town.
Yeah, you go down to the marketplace and something blows up in your face, yeah. You know, or your daughter or your son or your wife. Or there's all kinds of people that have lost their next of kin there and their close family members. And that all that does is create a lot of hate and resentment.
Yeah, absolutely. And there certainly are warring factions there. There are insurgents or whatever one wishes to deem them. But you wonder to what degree some of that violence is not orchestrated as well by the occupiers.
Provide
us additional rationale to stay there. Some of these coordinated bombings, I mean, they take place at several locations throughout the metropolitan area. I mean, they seem really much more sophisticated than any sort of ragtag group of insurgents could actually put together. And, of course, you know, there have been British forces that have been caught carrying out these types of things, being the agent provocateurs. This took place back in 2006. So they've been caught red-handed doing these types of things before. Of course, it's difficult to actually determine who it is because we've got such a corrupt system. So say the same thing about some of the events taking place here in the United States.
There are those that are asserting that maybe, just maybe, a Gladio type of operation has been underway in this country for a number of decades.
Yeah,
It makes you think that, yeah, all of these different shootings and mass murders or whatever is going on out here at any one time, that maybe they've been helped by certain, you know, back ops type operations.
Yeah, and they're not they're really not investigated to the degree that they actually should be. I mean, you know, we could go back to the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, the 1995 Oklahoma City federal building bombing. When you have an overarching, you know, a federal investigation and Justice Department that is, you know, perhaps on the take, or, you know, at the very least corrupt or incompetent, how can one get to the bottom of these types of things? That's the thing that's constantly, that's so frustrating. Same thing with Boston. The same thing with, for example, Sandy Hook. When will we ever find out what took place with these events if we have such an inept or corrupt system that we're paying with our tax dollars for?
Well, on the Sandy Hook, tragedy, where has the physical evidence been ever presented to any of us or authority or to the public?
No. And they're still actually conducting the investigation. It will have been 9 months now.
Well, do you think that's a way that they'll continue to deny some of the evidence to us by just continuing the investigation?
Well, last news that I heard is that they want to, and this is also reminiscent of Oklahoma City. They want to destroy the Sandy Hook Elementary School. They want to tear it down.
Okay.
And I think that this is up to a vote now in the new town. So the residents, the citizenry there, have to determine whether or not it should be torn down. But I think that that's the move that has been made by the town council there. And that's something that was actually proposed back in January. They wanted to do it back then. And then, we have no videos, no photographs or anything of the like of what actually took place inside there. And that's something the public should know. And granted, the press has been, a bit vociferous in this regard as well, requesting this information and asking why it hasn't been forthcoming. The Hartford Courant did a story a couple of weeks ago on the overtime pay that's been taken in by the Newtown Police and the State Police, $140,000, I believe, in overtime pay for just specifically on this investigation. And then they're going all over the country talking about their apparent observations with regard to the case. So it's still something that that's ongoing. I also have heard that H. Wayne Carver, the Connecticut medical examiner, of course, who had the famous press conference on December 15th, I heard that he retired. I haven't confirmed that or not. I'd like to check with the state of Connecticut, and verify his employment, but haven't done that quite yet. But this is something I heard several weeks ago.
That whole interview just was bizarre,
It sure was.
And they were laughing during the interview, and the photographs of a lot of the vehicles lined up in perfect order around the buildings and stuff, it just didn't look right, did it?
No, not at all. And, that is yet another of the sort of odd collection of events that we're just not, authorities are really just not explaining to us in a way that is satisfactory. And I've been toying with this notion of I haven't written a piece on this yet, but the idea of, it's kind of like everyone in the United States has a Mayberry effect.
Okay.
Not everyone. The Mayberry, North Carolina, where the Andy Griffith Show took place?
Oh, yeah, nice little friendly little town. And
right, yeah.
Oh, we just love America. Yeah.
There is this underlying notion that, the government's not going to hurt us. They're going to help us out. Could you imagine anyone ever doing anything like that or being corrupt like that? No, it's just like Mayberry. And, again, granted, not everyone is like that, obviously, but there's a significant portion of the population that are. And that allows for things like that, like this, to continue, to be perpetuated on the public. You know, there's a minority of us who are sitting over there saying, this is crazy. What's going on? Why isn't this being asked? Why isn't that being done?
But skepticism is healthy, is it? You know?
Absolutely. It's what this country is based upon.
But has there been? I see just a strong dash of political correctness in all of these events.
Yeah.
That if you're deviating somewhat from the standard propaganda or information put out, then you're weird or you're off of it. You're out of it. See, or you're a conspiracy nut or something like that. See.
That's right. Yeah, that is that's generally what people are kind of hit over the head with. And it's one thing if you're an independent researcher, but
right.
As I've experienced, you know, if you have some sort of an official title, then you can't say that. It's not acceptable. So.
And the university should be a place where we vigorously express a plethora of differing ideas, whether they're good ideas or not, or good theories or not, or how whatever. They should be vetted.
They absolutely should be. And, in the spirit of John Milton, the truth will win out. The most rational, well-argued, thing, the most argument will carry the day. And we could have a knockdown, drag-out, a quarrel exchange up until then. And yeah, that's how it should be. And that's how good science is furthered. There's disagreement. That's why the whole global warming thing is such
well, you know, like the word they framed him on criminal.
I'm sorry.
You know, in criminal law, where they'll say the person in prison say they framed me. They framed me.
Uh-huh.
Like they'll frame somebody. Well, I got to thinking today, we've all been framed, see?
Yeah.
And what we've done, what they've done, or whoever, or the way the system is operating, or the way it is today, is that we've all been placed within a certain frame of thinking, ideas, hypotheses, theories, and ways of thinking about the world and society and about the country. So we've all been framed. See what I mean?
Oh, I think so as well.
You see, that's a different way of looking at or using that word. See.
Well, that's something that our institutions do in terms of education,
yes.
And then there's
yes.
the whole continuing education of the mass media.
Yes.
That perpetuates that kind of that terminal childhood. Again, you know, Mayberry.
Yeah, Mayberry. Oh, I loved it. Little Jimmy and Georgie. We loved Mayberry, didn't we?
Huh? Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I just loved it. I could go to school there, and I'd bring the teacher an apple, and everything would be happy. And oh, there's a few little problems, but nothing insurmountable, was it? Huh?
Right, exactly. It's a social womb, you know.
You
don't have to really worry about any types of fears, or rather, threats from the external world. It's all, everything is hunky dory. And you know that series began in 1960. You know, it ran for several years. I'm not sure how many. It became something else as well, under a couple of different titles. But in 1960, when it did come out, there was still some degree of hope for that. You know,
right.
When John Kennedy became president, and I think that a lot of that was lost with his assassination. You had a You had a shadow government that really.
You know, when JFK was assassinated, was that just a tremendously milestone in the United States history, or a sea change occurred there?
Yeah, I think so because and here we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of it.
Yes.
November 22nd, and absolutely, that is the most significant event outside of 9/11, I think, in the past 50 years, because he was going to. There's so much stuff that he could have done if he were allowed to live. But of course, there's no point in talking about that because there were forces that were more powerful than him. But nevertheless, the things that he had on the drawing board, I think, were part, at least contributed in part to why he was killed. And right. that included, you know, silver certificates, actually money that's backed with something tangible. The fact that he had a plan to get us out of the, out of these entanglements, such as where we were in Southeast Asia and elsewhere in the world. The fact that he's going to get rid of the CIA, which is, at the time was a big part of our problem. Now that whole thing has mushroomed into all sorts of lettered agencies and a lot of private contractors as well. So it's just much, much worse than it was then.
Stephen Kinzer, the one that wrote all the Shaw's Men and many other books about our intervention in all these regimes around the world and all these different assassinations, has just, he'll be publishing officially. I got my review copy the other day. It's about the Dulles brothers and their secret world war, I think he said. You see what I mean?
Oh, that's great, yeah.
And you should read that thing. I mean, it reads like a wax museum of horrible creatures out there just doing all kinds of things.
Well, I can imagine. They were a big part of this.
Yes, they were. The brothers, one was Secretary of State and one was Director of the CIA. Yeah. John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State. And then Alan Dulles, and now Alan Dulles's background goes back to World War II in Switzerland and World War II in Switzerland again. Well, working, there is one thing, though, I've learned so far out of that book, is that one of the best things that Alan Dulles ever did, you know, he didn't do it all wrong, but but he did a lot of things, I think, that were mistakes. But he negotiated secret agreements with the commanders of the Italian and the Austrian German army, okay?
Uh-huh.
And what he basically did was get them to surrender early. Okay? And there's no telling how many American and Allied troops that did save in World War II.
Yeah, well, at the time as well, there were rumors about going off and fighting the Soviets. My dad was, he was in the 15th, he was in the Army Air Corps.
Right.
There were rumors at that time that they were just going to continue on and fight the Soviets. And, that did not come to pass. But that's all in that book, by that new book by Kinzer?
Yes, by Stephen Kinzer. He's a professor. He's a professor at Brown University there at Providence, Rhode Island.
Okay.
He lives in Boston. He's done some teaching there in Boston and Northwestern in Chicago. But he's a fine person as far as he's one of the best guys I've ever interviewed because we just hit it off, you know, our personalities.
Uh-huh.
And when I put things forward, he was the desk. He was head of the desk for New York Times, I think, in Istanbul for several years
as
a reporter besides his academic credentials. But, he's written a fine book there. So, I mean, I recommend it. It will be officially published October 1st of this year. And we already have arrangements to interview him on the book, so it should be quite an interview.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to this, the Americans have supported through the CIA and all this other stuff some of the most harsh regimes in the world. And dictatorship, Central America, we propped up one dictator after another. Smedley Butler says the Marines went down to collect money for the corporations for American business. See?
Yeah.
So, no wonder, but the average American didn't do this, but our big corporations, some of those did it.
Right. Well, and they, those corporations used the government and the military, to exert their will, as we saw. You know, in Central America in the early 1950s with the overthrow, for example, of the Arbenz regime, and
In Iran, look at that, what happened there in the 50s.
Pretty much the exact same time.
Yeah, and the president overthrown there believed in democracy and republicanism and everything else.
Yeah, and I think that he wanted to nationalize the oil.
Well, he did before he took over the presidency.
Right.
He made the National Assembly push through a vote before he accepted the presidency. He was elected president, but before he assumed office, he said, I want a vote in here about to nationalize the oil industry, and they went with it. So they nationalized the oil, and boy, that's when the oil companies, the British and Americans, went after him, see.
Sure. Yeah, and he was only in power for a couple of years, Mossadegh.
Yeah, Mossadegh, yeah, and they hung him in the end. A good guy, a good person.
Yeah.
What happened. It's evil stuff, you know?
Yeah, and that was, the technique that was used by Kermit Roosevelt is as well.
Yes, it was. Kermit headed up that, you know who along with him, who was with him over there too? General Schwarzkopf's father.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. These are the people that are our leaders. And Schwarzkopf on the Persian Gulf War denied those logs to the public about those incoming scuds and the type of chemical and biological warfare stuff that they contaminated our troops with.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, father like son, like father like son, you know?
Yeah, that's just a terrible crime.
But they put those people up as great leaders and great heroes. They're not, see?
No way.
Because they're playing for the big interest and the big money. That they're all wanting that money, the big retirement. They don't want to lose that. And they lose their soul when they sell out to these interests. See?
Well, you know, you could say the same or very similar things about most of government employees, whether in the military or intelligence or what have you. You know, they're really concerned more so about protecting their pension in the agency.
Exactly.
And, they don't care anything about the public.
No.
And that's a really big problem. You know, I don't know if you came across, there's a book that was published earlier this year by a journalist by the name of Trevor Aronson called The Terror Factory, that is all about how the FBI, sets up informants and sting operations, and he looks in the court documents and finds that 95% of the alleged terror events that have taken place that the FBI has investigated since the War on Terror began.
And what is that called? The terror what now?
Called the Terror Factory.
The Terror Factors, okay.
Terror Factory, yeah.
Terror Factor, okay.
Factory.
Oh, that's Factory, Terror Factory, okay. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's something to – that's a good recommendation then from you.
Well,
was there any final concluding comments you'd like to make? We've got about a minute here.
Well, again, it's going to be a very nerve-wracking weekend, given what could potentially take place. So I think that we'll all attempt to keep our fingers crossed, I guess, that Obama doesn't do what is not right, what is completely unjust. Other than that, George, it's been a wonderful conversation, and I really appreciate you having me here.
Well, I thank you very much, and we certainly will support you in every which way we can, okay?
I appreciate that. Thanks very much, George.
Okay, Dr. Tracy, thank you. Good night.
Good night.